The Jewish Hour can now be heard on jcastnetwork.org, your portal to Jewish broadcasting. It's also on iTunes and on your smartphone using the Stitcher app. Welcome to the Jewish Hour. I'm your host, Herschel Fenman. We've got a great show. Tonight is Chanukah for you, and so, of course, we're going to be doing Chanukah stuff. In this half hour of the show, we are going to be interviewing the renowned artist, Archie Rand, has composed a book called The 613. It is an artist's rendition of all 613 commandments. This is a tome, let me tell you, folks. Concerning music, we opened up with a CD called The City of the Future. It's Yael Strom's latest. We've had Yael on before. I just want to get a little history before we get into this whole thing, why I played this CD. It is, he did some archiving and looking around and came up with a whole CD of music which was popular in Russia in 1931. Many of the songs are Stalin populist, and I just hated them. The CD just like was it was either nothing that I liked or the songs weren't really with it together. Some of the arrangements I didn't really care for. So I called up Yael and we had a long talk. And he said, well, I sent it to you. You should play something of it. So I played it for Yael Strom. That's the CD. It's called The City of the Future. If you want it, contact me on rabbifinman.com and I'll sell it to you. But I'll send it to you, not sell it to you. We have other music that's really good for you. The portion of the week is the portion of Miketz. It's Hanukkah. We'll probably talk about Hanukkah more than Miketz. We will be closing with an awesome Hanukkah story. Before we do anything else, let's go right to the news. Israel is taking diplomatic steps to pose hurdles to six EU countries who led the boycott of goods made in Yehuda Shomron and the Golan. The six countries are Sweden, France, Luxembourg, Belgium, Ireland, and Malta. The Israeli Air Force bombed a weapons convoy and munitions storage facilities on Syria's border with Lebanon. According to the report, the targeted storage facility housed long-range surface-to-surface missiles that Syria had transferred to the Hezbollah terrorist group. A number of Hezbollah fighters and Syrian military soldiers were reported killed in the strike. The Lod District Court sentenced Hassan Khalil Hizran to a year and a half in jail for recruiting Hezbollah terrorists in Israel. Khalil, a Swedish citizen of Lebanese descent, was arrested at Ben-Gurion Airport. And finally, Beth Israel Synagogue of Peterborough, Ontario, invited members of the local mosque to use their temple for prayer services after a firebomb caused more than $80,000 in damage. Police believe it is part of a wave of anti-Muslim crimes following the recent terror attacks in Paris. And that's the news.
Some of the best jobs in the world are in the radio and television industry, and you too can join the workforce in as little as 8 months when you complete your hands-on training at the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts located in Southfield, Michigan. At Specs Howard School, students get to play and learn at the same time. Imagine spending your class time behind the microphone, spinning music and hosting your own radio show, or designing and lighting a set for your own TV program, running a camera, learning to edit, directing a program. When you go to Specs, your day will be anything but dull. And if school is this fun, imagine how exciting it is to work in the growing industry. In addition, the credits you earn while attending Specs Howard School are currently accepted at 14 area colleges and universities. If you've always wanted the best job in the world, call for a tour of Specs Howard School at 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000. Or visit them on the web at specshoward.edu. Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. This is where you start.
Herschel Fenman, who are you listening to the Jewish Hour? We have on the line Our famed artist Archie Rand has just come out with a book called The 613, his depiction and portrayal of all 613 commandments plus. How are you today, Archie?
Okay. Baruch Hashem. How are you, Herschel?
Good. Thank you so much for coming on. This is an exciting piece. When I heard about this, I just went, wow, that's absolutely incredible that someone would actually go to depict 613 commandments. So let's hear some of the backstory about what was your impetus in doing it, Archie?
Well, for a number of years, I had been working with Jewish subject matter. My children had gone to the Yeshiva Flatbush, and I became involved with doing murals that had Jewish content. Unaware at the time, being a secular artist, that there was not only an understood but not necessarily halachic prescription against making art. I just thought I was an artist and this was an interesting thing to do. And as the years went on, I realized that my friends who were artists were very disturbed by the fact that I was doing Jewish subject matter in what would ordinarily be considered secular work. And I took that as a challenge. I said, there's something wrong here. And for many years, I struggled with the idea of whether or not I could merge this into my secular output I was showing in New York. And by about 1985, it sort of collapsed. A couple of critics noticed that in some of my large-scale mural work that I was bringing in things that could be interpreted as, you know, midrashic illustrations. And I figured, okay, I don't have to keep these separate anymore. And then I decided that if I'm going to do this, oh, I should back up. I'm sorry. Can I do that? I can back up.
Yes, that's fine.
In 1974, I was given a commission to do the interior of an Orthodox synagogue to do about 8,000 to 12,000 square feet of murals. And some members of the synagogue became very disturbed that there was painting. So the case, it wasn't brought to a Beit Din, but it was brought to Harav Moshe Feinstein of blessed memory. And Moshe Feinstein, to my shock, said not only is Jewish art permissible, but under almost all circumstances, it can be done. And I figured,
Archie, let me interrupt over here. Let's back up a little bit even more than that. Let's get a little bit of backstory. What was the objection of the congregation to the art that you were picking? I'm sure it looked nice.
Well, yeah, there were two major objections. This was Congregation B'nai Yosef in Brooklyn, which is now rather famous as the Painted Shul, at least among Jewish art circles. One was that when I was painting Bereshit, I said, well, you know, before the creation of light, there's the visual equivalent of an absence of light, which is black. So before I put the imagery on the walls, I painted the wall black, and some members of the congregation saw that as a, for lack of a better word, a superstitious, but I wouldn't credit them with something so base as that, but they didn't like the black on the wall. And at that point, they decided that since there was no precedent for having paintings in the shul, that what I was doing was halakhically improper.
Have been art in synagogues. I mean, the Chagall windows are how old already? That, you know.
Yeah, but the Chagall windows are not in synagogues.
That's true. They're in the hospital.
And also, stained glass windows were imported from the church. That is, it's not a Jewish tradition. And the reason that stained glass windows are allowed is because the transparency of the glass makes the imagery non-tangible and therefore not capable of being idolatrous because you're basically looking through it. So some of the technicalities of the halakha become very, very strained at that point. So there's many, many synagogues with stained glass windows, but because it's obviously glass and not a corporeal object, there's no rabbinical question as to whether or not it's kosher or not.
Mm-hmm. So this mural that you were painting in the synagogue in Flatbush, Brooklyn, was it in the sanctuary? Was it in the lobby or the social hall?
It was in the sanctuary. In fact, the first thing they asked me to do was to do a kind of scale model of the Kotel. And I had a wall about 30 feet high and maybe 40, 50 feet across that was divided by two windows. And I did that first. And that was very successful. So they said, oh, you can continue to paint the rest of the place. And the rest of the place is this large large sanctuary. So at first I put down the menorah, then I put down the Magen David, and then I said, you know, I've got 38 more panels to go, all of them 10 feet high and 15 feet across. It was an enormous amount of space. And I ran out of imagery. I said, so I started to research and realized there was none because of numerous circumstances. And I had to go down to the Lakewood Yeshiva, where I sat and learned with the students there, and found out basically just what situations and what nouns, basically, nouns. You know, it says, Hashem does this, there's this fish, there's this chair, there's this tree, and I said, okay, now I've got some images. But I realized at the same time what Rav Moshe said was that when you use your skills as an artist, if you use them for the glory of Hashem, then that's permitted by the community and even lauded by the community. And if you don't, he very cryptically answered, then you will have to answer for that. And I assume he mentioned answer in the world to come. So I thought, okay, if somebody has a picture in their house of a glowing Magen David or a glowing menorah, that's very nice. That's communal identification. But that doesn't further the process of meditation with, you know, any further meditation necessarily. I mean, it could. But, you know, if you're an artist and if you have this mission to do something, you know, al kiddush Hashem, then you really have to do something a little bit deeper. And at that point, I ran into a problem. I said, you know, what is it that you could do? And I'm digressing a bit, but at that time, there were also many artists who were working what they called Kabbalistically, which I always found a kind of a ruse. Not that I doubt that people have genuine Kabbalistic interest, but the lay person, you know, is going to find that very abstruse information. So some painters will do very abstract works and have a couple of letters of the alphabet floating around in it and a couple of circles, and they'll tell you that they meditated for 20 years and came up with this image. And I have no reason not to believe that. I figure, okay, that's perfectly valid, and this artist is apparently a very mystic person, or these many artists. But that's not going to help the regular person identify more with their conversation.
Yeah, let me jump in right here. One of the points of contention that my wife and I had is in the DIA, there is a painting by Newman, Barnett Newman. Yeah. So I walked up, and I'm not an artist, so, and if I can do it, then to me it's not art. And then there is an 8 foot wide by 6 foot high painting.
It's
burgundy with a white line down the middle. And I said, why is there a painting of a ping pong table on the wall here? And she got very mad. And she went, this whole thing, no, that's supposed to be like the introduction of God's infiniteness into the holy void. And it's just like, you know, it looks like a ping pong table. So you're right, as far as interpretive art, when you're talking about modern things and when you're talking about such ethereal concepts as Jewish mysticism, it could get really lost on people.
I'm with your wife on this one. One of the problems that we have as Jews is that for many reasons, both internally and externally, the digestive tract for absorbing the visual has been amputated from us as a people. And that has gone into basically accepting the literate. So we're people of ideas, we're people of learning, we're people of reading. The notion of absorbing the visual as information, that you looked at that and you saw a ping pong table, you made a literal transcription of what it was you were seeing. And that's the perfectly normal, you know, more often than not, Jewish response to abstract pictures. Your wife, however, for some reason, Baruch Hashem, has some visual digestive juices. And what Barnett Newman is doing is, I'm not going to repeat it, but it's very much what your wife said. The problem that I have, getting back to the 613, is that a lot of this information, Barnett Newman was a Kabbalist. He was a deeply learned, not an observant person, but he was, in fact, his first catalog was written by a non-Jewish person, a museum director, who spent the whole time going through medieval Kabbalistic symbols and what it meant to Newman. But Newman is basically a straight abstract painter. He's kind of like Mark Rothko with a witness in it. You know, it's like the sublime thing. But what I thought about was that the Tariag Mitzvot is something that most Jews, unless they're very observant, will not even look at in their entire lifetime. They won't even know they exist. In fact, since the book has come out, conservative and reform Jews have said to me, I didn't even know there was 613.
I hear that all the time.
Yeah, and I thought, you know, this is a very interesting challenge. That is, I've done things like I did the 39 forbidden labors of Shabbat. I've done the 54 pashas. And I thought, you know, if I'm going to take on something at the very armature of Yiddishkeit, at the very heart of Judaism, I can't do it in a way that might be seen as a New Yorker cartoon or a kind of, you know, flip approach to something. I need something so enormous that no matter how silly or offhanded it may seem, which is in fact my outreach towards the visual digestive tract, the simple number of it is going to quell any notions that this is in fact a joke on my part. So the 613 became that kind of challenge. It became, you know, let's do something that's very, very, very Jewish. And let's do something that's so big that nobody can think I'm making fun of it, even though the pictures seem very comic. So in a certain sense, it's a very inept kind of missionizing to the most far-reaching aspects, not only of non-affiliated Jews. And I must tell you, I myself am not an observant person, but I love being Jewish and I love the Jewish people. And I figured this is, you know, everyone has their place, like Reb Moshe said. And I figured, you know, this is interesting also. I've been getting letters from evangelical groups, non-Jews, who are very appreciative that they're having this aspect of Tanakh sent to them. So I figured, what I really have to do here, because you said, you know, I'm portraying the 613. I'm not really portraying them. They're not illustrations. As you've well found out from looking at the book, there are some pictures that seem to make no sense when compared with the commandment. Mm-hmm. And what I figured was I had to make the visual primary, which is different than what most Jewish artists do, which is making the textual primary. Because if I'm going too fast, stop me. When you make the text primary, you end up illustrating. And when you end up illustrating, you go right back to square one again. That is, you go back to a reinvestment in learning, which is what the Orthodox outreach groups do, which is very commendable. But there are people, especially in this digital age, that haven't got the patience or the interest to go back to traditional learning. So I figured what I have to do now is, since I have the Heksher and since I have the 2,000 year trajectory since we lost our centrality in Yerushalayim, to reinvest Yiddishkeit with the visual, I have to go to the farthest ends of that diagram, of that perimeter, and get those people who haven't the faintest interest in this thing, but simply think the drawings or the paintings are cool. And then they will end up having read a mitzvah that they never would have come across in their entire life. It never would have opened up. And a majority of the people who are buying this book, in fact, are not observant. They just think it's cool. And meanwhile, I've placed the Tayag mitzvot into households that never would have had them.
Indeed.
And I figure this is a good use of my life at this point.
Yeah. Indeed. If you're just tuning in, our guest today is Archie Rand. He's an artist, put together a book of his paintings, The 613 Commandments. Did you, when first of all, let me ask you, how long did it take you to paint all 613 of these pictures? And how big are the original pictures?
The pictures are 20 by 16 inches. But
so that's fair size.
Yeah, it was planned as one painting, though. That is, they were at the back of the book, there's a photograph of the installation in my studio. And the actual painting is literally 100 feet long and 17 and a half feet high. It's one enormous picture. And when the idea of the book came up and we realized we would have to put the individual panels of the painting into it, it was only at that point that we decided it was essential that we put the specific mitzvah that is numbered in the Hebrew numbering system on the painting with the visual image. But the book represents one piece of work. It's basically a mural of the Tayag mitzvah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you have in mind, did you want to be edgy in your depiction of these mitzvahs?
It was absolutely necessary, because if you're not edgy, then you're addressing the very community that has two demerits as far as the visual is concerned. The first is that they will not accept even the notion of applying the visual to the mitzvot. And the second is that demand that the pictures be, in fact, illustrative to the point of rabbinical commentary. And the more, as I said before, the more textually dominant the pictures become, the less effective they become visually, because the more they replicate the dominant text. So in order to do that, I had to go outside of the text and make pictures that were first familiar, available, even silly, that would attract the visual attention and then put the textual second, which seems like possibly in this day and age a non-Jewish or disrespectful thing to do. But in fact, it's not, because we have evidence of very fine Jewish wall art existing in the second century at the time of the Talmud. And the fact that very little of that exists since the second century is a matter of the destruction of these buildings. But certainly this work had been done. There was a Jewish component of the visual in early temple era Yiddishkeit, and I simply wanted to find some way among a number of other artists to start to reestablish that, so that we were not cut off from that sensate appetite that all humans have. Am I getting anywhere with this?
Yeah, I hear where you are. Yes, indeed, you answered the question exactly 100%. There, different rabbis over the centuries have codified the 613 in different orders, mm-hmm. and I'm not familiar with the order that you chose.
I was under the assumption, this is very surprising, I was under the assumption that I was using Rambam's order, and I actually pulled the number off a Chabad website.
Okay.
So one of us is...
I'm not up on the end of... I never got to the end of Sefer HaMitzvahs from the Rambam.
I hope it's not me, but if so, I did it with the right intentions anyway.
Okay, so you chose the Rambam's order of things, and therefore the Rambam's interpretation as to what is a mitzvah and what isn't, because it doesn't say anywhere. First of all, the mitzvahs are enumerated in the five books of Moses, but they don't say, here's mitzvah number one, here's mitzvah number two. They just say, you should do this or you shouldn't do this. And Maimonides himself, at the introduction to his Sefer HaMitzvahs, the book of mitzvahs, gives nine general principles as to determining, when you're looking at a verse, is it a mitzvah? Is it part of a mitzvah? Is it not a mitzvah at all? So there, whereas he has his 613, so my Nachmanides has his 613, the Minchas Chinuch has his 613, and there's various and sundry lists as to what is a mitzvah, what's not a mitzvah.
Right, I've seen lists of 617, 623. I mean, I, at some point I had to draw the line along the most traditionally available not only number, but the order that I found to be most popular, if no other phrase could be used. But it was, as far as further research, that was arbitrary, favoring simply consensus, and that mm-hmm. was what I found on the internet. I mean, I had every book I could find. I went to all the Jewish bookstores and bought every book I could find on the mitzvot, and most of them seemed fairly consistent, with the exception of those that divided it into the positive and negative mitzvot. And I just figured it was better if I just ran them through. It was more fun to do that thou shalt and thou shalt not alternating than just doing all the thou shalt nots and all the thou shalt.
Yeah, you get kind of steeped in the negative.
I wanted to mix it up.
Yes. I hear you. So how did you, I mean, if you could just talk generally, I don't want to ask you, but I ask you, why did you pick this picture? Why did you pick that picture? That we would be here for weeks. But is there a general, once you got into the flow of things, did you sort of take a mitzvah, for example, not to substitute one animal for another animal, which is something I just happened to open the book up at random. And by that point, you're sort of in a groove and said, oh yeah, I should do it this way.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. There's one of the things that's happened after doing, work with and for religious institutions for many years is you sort of get these strange feelings, and I don't even know if these are kosher or admissible feelings, that your intuition is in fact validated by a higher power. And there's a certain kind of arrogance that you really don't want to advertise about that. But at the same time, the alternative to that is the kind of illustration that doesn't fire the imagination. So, you know, one gets an image in one's head and says, I don't know why exactly, but if I'm thinking this as part of a larger, you know, human organism, then it's quite possible that other people will somehow resonate with this. Not necessarily get it, because I'm not even sure if I get it, you know, but sometimes you're simply told to do something, and you realize that what you're doing is something greater. You're doing, you know, chidur ha-mitzvah, and you figure, you know, at this point, if you pull back, that actually is, you'll pardon the use of my hyperbole here, but if you actually pull back and try to restrain yourself, in a funny sense, in my position as a professional artist, it's chilul Hashem, because you're not supposed to deny the intuitive impulse that you feel is given to you with the proper reasoning. That is, it's a certain kind of mystical allowance that I and many artists give themselves, which is not necessarily something that I want to talk about in terms of ethics, because that can validate a whole bunch of terrible things. But, you know, the art isn't really hurting anybody, as long as I'm doing it, as Reb Moshe said, with the right intentions. So I figured my intentions were right. I wanted to pick up an image that, in fact, would be startling but not transgressive. So there's a difference, as I mentioned in the introduction, there's a difference between subversion and transgression. And subversion can be interesting to start conversation. Transgression is simply an act of traitorous attack. And there was no place in the 613 that I was interested in doing anything that wasn't for the benefit of the community. So when these images come up, they are in fact, you know, I confess, they are in fact intuitive images, but they're catchy. They make you read a mitzvah that, you know, you're a rav, you know, you don't have to worry about this. But, you know, I have friends that that are not observant or don't even identify, and they think this book is cool. And I have this book sitting in their house like some time bomb, and they pick it up and they read it while they're smoking whatever they're smoking and drinking whatever they're drinking, and they're reading the mitzvot. I figured this is very funny to me. It's actually very cool. That's sort of like, you know, part of the intention. Not that I intended it to be a as I said in the beginning, a piece of missionizing. I needed to make this manifest or tangible in the world as a legitimate article to address visually, simply because Judaism needed to open up its capacity for visual absorption. And this was the heaviest and most serious topic I could approach. Mm-hmm. So when the images come up, they come up. You know.
Okay. If you're just tuning in, our guest today is Archie Randi. He's an artist, put together a book called The 613, illustrating all 613 commandments. Since you brought it up, when I was a kid, we used to sit around in various states of consciousness and analyze the lyrics to Beatles songs. Could you imagine people sitting around and saying, well, why did he pick that image for that commandment?
It's already happened. I had these. Once we realized the book was going to go into print, a weird thought occurred to me. Not that I want to get my ego involved in this, you know, but I thought there's whole generations of people who sit around and analyze Bob Dylan lyrics. And I've gotten many reviews on the book, and already in three of the reviews, the reviewers have made assumptions about the pictures that had nothing to do with whatever you can lightly call my intentions were. And I thought, this is wonderful. These pictures are actually working their chemical magic. Yes, people can sit around and analyze Beatles lyrics if they like, and I should be so honored that somebody should actually think about analyzing the for lack of a better word, the iconography in these pictures. But of course it's going to happen, because the disconnect is great between the commandment and the image. So in a certain sense, I'm taunting or I'm tempting that process to occur. But again, it was never done with the intention of being a wise guy. I state my wise guy credentials in the introduction and then drop it there. The work exists as the work exists. People will make conjectures about, you know, what the imagery represents in relationship to the mitzvah. And I figure, you know, that means that somebody spent 10 minutes thinking about a mitzvah that never would have occurred them to even read in their entire life. So that's really a good thing. Let them conjecture.
Indeed, fascinating. Now, there had been for many years an installation at the DIA. What it was 100 television screens. And each television screen was like playing some other movie or something like that. But when you step back, what you saw was the image of an American flag over the 100 TV screens.
Mm-hmm.
If you step back from this 100-foot by 17.5-foot installation that you've created, do you get a singular image?
Yes, because as I said, these images were originally pixels in a much larger painting, which does exist. The San Francisco Contemporary Museum of Jewish Art is going to show it as a painting in 2017. The painting was originally conceived in a much more humble fashion. That is, when the artist has all the television sets forming the American flag, that's an idea. And the idea can later be translated, as you just did, into a verbal message, the American flag. But the visual, as your wife well knows, works a little bit differently. It's not really able to be articulated back into words. It has its own kind of language. And the original 613 has the edges of each panel painted in what appears to be an orange-yellow in the book, but it's actually gold paint. And the images, as they're actually painted, are a little bit more matte and a little bit flatter than they appear in the book. And when the picture is assembled and all the panels are contiguous, the entire painting reflects this kind of warm golden glow into which you can individually perceive or enter the specific imagery. And when I was doing it, I was thinking basically of all the time we had lost as a visual culture and had to make up in terms of what world cultures have in their sacred spaces. And I thought, you know, Yiddishkeit has its own particular kind of sacredness. You know, it says that when Bezalel built the Mishkan, that it was filled with a substance. And that substance is sort of described as like jello. It's real substance, and the substance is holiness. And I thought the reflection off of these panels, when coalesced into this 1800 square foot painting, sends this glow towards the viewer, which is basically physical. You can bathe in it like sunlight. It really reflects. And you know, that's sort of the effect I was looking for in the initial painting. I wanted something that would announce its intention as you know, one can triangulate the thinking. This is the glow of the Tariag Mitzvot. Now, if you get into it individually, of course, there's millions of questions you can ask. And how many people have not debated every single one of these? Which is fine. That's the viewer's prerogative visually. But the first thing I want the viewer to see is this wall of faintly glowing yellow aura coming off the picture in which the viewer is enveloped. In the book, it's very different. The book, as I said, concentrates on the individual, you know, factors that make that up.
Right. I mean, if you're going to do it where you'd have to pick the whole thing, you'd have to make it 100 feet by 17.5 feet. So,
yeah,
indeed. So where is this work hanging now? Is it?
No, the work is in storage now. It's very difficult to find a venue that accommodates two difficult criteria. One is it has to have the space, which is it's very hard to find any institution that has 1,800 square feet of solid running space. And the second thing is it's Jewish. And Jewish imagery has been sort of curtailed from the visual discourse by mutual agreement of the Jewish community, which uses the art world to assimilate, and the non-Jewish community, which has no interest to be kind, and on the far right, you know, anti-Semitic impulses about allowing Jewish imagery into the discourse. So it's very difficult to find an institution that will favor or applaud Jewish subject matter, and it's very difficult to find an institution that will, in fact, have the physical wall space to accommodate the painting. All of that was understood before I did it. I didn't do it to become you know, the person who installed this picture. I did it because it needed to be done. But right now it's packed up in storage, and, you know, thank God the San Francisco Jewish Museum is going to install it, which is something I'm looking forward to, because it hasn't been installed since that photograph on the back of the book, which was in my own warehouse studio.
How long will it be in San Francisco?
I'm sorry?
How long will it be in San Francisco?
I think it's going to be about a four-month show. They gave it a nice chunk of time there.
But we have to wait to 2017, and we have to get to San Francisco. So, okay, we are...
So if any institutions out there are interested, you know, when I did it, I thought, you know, thinking in my Pollyannish way, you know, I've been in the art world all my life. That is, you know, for years before I started doing Jewish work, I was showing in major galleries. And I thought to myself, wow, I've just done something really, really strange and really interesting. I bet the Whitney at the Guggenheim is going to take this. And they didn't answer my letters, much less say, thank you, we're not interested. And I figured, oh, I had a kind of shock of realization there of the second proscription that I mentioned to you. That is, you know, this language is not really acceptable in the larger artistic discourse. You know, that kind of identity politics, that kind of identity art is still sort of on the outside for a number of reasons. Mm-hmm. So we'll wait to 2017, and
we'll maybe have to take a group tour to San Francisco in 2017 when it comes up.
I'll meet you there.
Okay, Archie, this is wonderful. Please keep us apprised of the goings on of the 613 and what happens with your wonderful work. And we want to thank you so much for coming on the Jewish Hour.
Thank you very much, Herschel. It was a pleasure. A great honor to speak to you, and thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. Take care. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour.
The Art Studio of Oak Park is now accepting students. Whether you're a real beginner or have been at it for a lifetime, the Art Studio of Oak Park has something for you. All levels welcome, all ages welcome. Private tutoring or small friendly classes. Flexible hours available. The Art Studio of Oak Park is very affordable. Make your life better. Put art into your life. The Art Studio of Oak Park offers lessons in a strictly kosher environment. Call today, 248-542-5087. That's 248-542-5087. It's great having an art room right in the neighborhood.
Herschel Finman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. I didn't even really have to think to do that interview. That was awesome. That was just like, you know, I hope you got the same vibes that I did. And I hope you go out and run out and get the book, Archie Rand's The 613. It's Blue Rider Press, which is a division of Random House. And this is a tome you're going to want to put right on your coffee table. As far as dimensions goes, it's not a coffee table size book. It's a coffee table size thickness, but it's the size of a regular book, you know, eight inches by six inches. And absolutely wild. Now, for your listening pleasure, we're doing something Hanukkah-esque. It's not really a Hanukkah song. This is Avram Fried. The song is called Ur, which means light, and the words are a little bit of light, push away a lot of darkness, and this is just for you.
A little bit of light, a little bit of light.
Assurance of quality and excellence in kosher? Look for the Michigan K on the label. What's it look like? The Lower Peninsula of Michigan with a K. It's the symbol of the Michigan Kosher Supervisors. Go to their website, mikosup.com. That's M-I for Michigan, K-O for kosher, and S-U-P for supervisors, mikosup.com, and find this month's featured products. You'll find Michigan K products wherever fine food is sold, especially at Natural Food Patch on West 9 Mile Road in Ferndale.
Hey, Shul Finman here. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. You interested in public menorah lightings? In Detroit area, there are public menorah lightings every single night, except for Friday and Saturday night. I don't know if somebody's doing Saturday night. It's early enough, but we're not even doing one then. Okay, so this is the rundown. Tonight at 4:30, Commerce Township at 810 Sleeth Street. That's the Chabad of Commerce place. They'll have a children's program and cider, donuts, etc. Between 3 and 8 at Campus Marshes downtown, they're having a whole program. The ceremony of the lighting ceremony is at 5 o'clock till 6 o'clock. From 3 to 5 is a children's program. From 6 to 8 is a happy hour. That's at Campus Marshes. There's a food truck, a food court, etc. Monday, we find ourselves at the City Hall of Southfield. Well, they have an LED display and show. That's at 5:30. Tuesday, you go to Birmingham Shane Park at 7 p.m., where the Pella Ensemble, it's an a cappella group local here, will be performing at their menorah lighting. Wednesday, take it to Farmington Hills, where you have at the Farmington City Hall, which is on 11 and Orchard Lake Road, and they'll have musical accompaniment and dancing and food there. Thursday is at Orchard Mall. This is the only indoor one. There'll be a concert at Rogers Park. We've played them here. There's a duo. One of them actually now lives in Detroit, and that's at 6 p.m. And then next Sunday is Jewish Ferndale will be doing their thing at the Kulik Center, which is on Livernois and 8.5 miles, which is called Marshall's, at 6 p.m. They'll be having members of the Ferndale community concert band, the Klezmer Ensemble, will be playing there and will be dressed, and there'll be refreshments, and that's open to the family as well. Are you doing something? Drop me a line, rabbifinman.com, and we'll let you know about it right here. We got time for one more song. Since it's Hanukkah, this is Hanukkah 2015 is the name of the song, and the group is called 613.
Lockers, I can smell the olives. And sometimes it's you've got me. Light them candles in the window. Boy, that's good.
Lockers. Yum.
Shalom.
Hey.
Do you or someone you know have an addiction to opiates? Ready to take your life back but don't have the time for a long inpatient program? MDS Drug Detox is a team of physicians with extensive experience in the field of rapid drug detox under anesthesia. MDS is the nation's only rapid opiate detox under anesthesia facility with the same doctors, RNs, and certified paramedics attending the entire drug detox process. MDS Drug Detox is safe and effective. Their goal is to provide the best, the safest, and the most economical way to free you from your addiction. MDS uses the highest standards of care and the best FDA-approved medications. MDS Drug Detox understands what your concerns are. Make the call today, 888-637-6968, or go online to www.mdsdrugdetox.com. That's 888-637-6968, MDS Drug Detox. Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800.
Herschel Fitman here, listening to the Jewish Hour. I am taking today's monologue from a book of sermons composed by Rabbi Schnur Poulter, who is a local Detroiter. It's 101 magnificent Torah sermons, if he does say so himself. So taking from, it's actually a mash, whatever you call it, of last week's and Hanukkah's together, and talking about a very perplexing thing that Jacob is called Israel by God, yet, for the most part, he's called Jacob till the end of the book, until he dies. It's not till the book of Exodus that we refer to him as the children of Israel. There's one place, though, where he's speaking with Joseph. So what's the deal when talking with Joseph that Jacob is referred to as Israel? So we see that Israel's the higher name. Okay, Israel is in reference to the brain, the head. So it says that Joseph was worthy of the higher and more prestigious name of Israel because he withstood far more than did his brothers. He withstood the scorn and contempt of his brothers. He withstood incarceration in Egypt for 12 long years, and he withstood all the temptations of Israel. So to his children, Ephraim and Manasseh, who were raised in the capital of Epicureanism and cultural smut, they rose above the fray and remained steadfast to God. The lesson of Hanukkah is also the same. It is a lesson to us today. If we are to be like the Maccabees and all they stood for and represented, then we are worthy of being called Israel, both in being counted among the children of Israel and observing and deserving the land of Israel. If, however, God forfend, to behave as the Hellenists, the secularists, the Jewish apostates, then Israel's not our face. We'll have to stew with Jacob, which refers to the heel. We must strive to follow in the footsteps of Joseph, Judah Maccabee, his brave and holy brothers, and his father, Matisyahu. Don't be popular, be bold, and do the right thing always. Speaking of right thing, we're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour.
Hi, this is Specs Howard from the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. We're happy to sponsor The Jewish Hour and bring quality radio programming to the community. While much of the funding for The Jewish Hour comes from its sponsors, it's listeners like you that help keep The Jewish Hour on the air. Please send your tax-deductible donation to The Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. That's 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. Your help is greatly appreciated.
Hey, Shul Finman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Want to get in touch with me? Way to do that? RabbiFinman.com. I'm also available on Facebook as Rabbi Finman, the Jewish Ferndale. You can see me on Facebook over there. Keep up what's going on with Ferndale and environs. There's a new project that we're doing there. And we'll find other things on RabbiFinman.com. You'll find the E-Parsha, the U-Parsha, the Hasidic U-Story, classes, and the very important donations page. Guess what? Today's December 6th. Guess what? We still haven't paid for November. Guess what? We need you to go to the computer sometime really soon and make a donation to support the Jewish Hour. Keep it on air. We're going into 20 years now. We've only been able to do it because of people like you stepping up and shelling it out, donating to the Jewish Hour. Do it. It's tax deductible. You got the end of the year is coming up. Take a look. You know, go on your computer, see how much you've got left to hit your 10% if that's what you do, and send it off to the Jewish Hour. We're good. God loves that. The IRS will love it. The listeners will love it. You'll love it because you're doing the right thing. Do it today. Don't like doing internet credit card stuff. I understand. Send your donation, any amount, to the Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. So it happened about 300 years ago. Rabbi Baruch Mezhebuz, who was the grandson of the Baal Shem Tov, was lighting the menorah the first night of Hanukkah. And he had some Hasidim there with him, some of his students. It was blizzarding. It was very, very snowy, to say the least. So they lit the candle, and after a short period of time, the candle went out. Now, the Rebbe was standing there the whole time, and he's looking. His secretary, Shamish, wanted to light the candle again, but the Baal Shem Tov just kind of like, the Rebbe Baruch just like kind of waved him away. And the rabbi stood there looking at the candle and encouraged the Hasidim to sing songs, Hanukkah songs, for quite some time. A long time passed by, and they heard footsteps, a carriage pulling up, and as the carriage pulled up, the candle relit itself. So he said, "What's the deal? That doesn't happen. Hello?" Guy comes in. He's one of the students of Rav Baruch Mezhebuz. Mezhebuz, by the way, is a small city many miles east of Grosse Pointe Farms. And he tells this story that he was traveling by his carriage by himself and was really trying to make time because he wanted to be first night of Hanukkah with his rabbi, with his rabbi. And he got lost in the woods, and it's snowing, it's blizzarding, and he got overcome by bandits. And they figured if he's traveling by himself in such an area, he must be really wealthy, because who else would be stupid enough besides somebody who's motivated by money to go out in this kind of weather? So they took him, they beat him up, they were going to want his money, he didn't have any money. Finally, one of the gang said, you know, came over to the side, I'm Jewish. And this is not right. I believe that you're going to travel to your Rebbe. And he let him go. Okay? But by that time, it was pitch black in the forest. And the horse just got spooked and wouldn't move. Suddenly, a small flickering flame appeared before the horse. And the horse just followed it right to the door. That's going to do it for us. That's what happened to the flame. That's going to do it for us. We hope we had a chance to entertain you a bit. We hope we had a chance to educate you a bit. We hope you have an awesome Hanukkah this week. Tonight's the first night. Yay! Eat those latkes. Eat those donuts. Eat those berekas. Whatever it is that you eat, cheese. It's all good. Just do it one more night, the next night, and then the next night, and one more, and one more, and one more. And we'll see you back again next week. Take care.